I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I host a show entitled A Matter of Public Records that is broadcast on KBOO the second and fourth Saturdays of every month from 3 to 6 a.m. It is a somewhat eclectic show where the song choices are often instinctual, based on the prior song. Tune in and you might hear some instrumentals, some slightly avant-garde music, punk, post-punk, indie rock, jazz. To my ears, it is a classic late-night radio show. That's A Matter of Public Records, every second and fourth Saturday from 3 to 6 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Remember the days of wandering the pumpkin patches in search of just the right one to bring home? Not too big, not too small, but with a little bit of personality? Well, the days of mucking through the chilled autumn air are over. Now you can grab a KBOO pumpkin crew neck or long sleeve that fits just right and keeps your elbows protected from the elements. Pick up an organic, homegrown, community-sourced piece of merch in gray, green, navy, or maroon and rock this autumn in style. Just check out the sidebar on our website at kboo.fm to harvest your KBOO pumpkin apparel today.
KBOO.
Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. The music you just heard is Casa de las Flores, House of Flowers, by Quijarre Ma. I've told you about Quijarre Ma in the past, and it connects with one of our themes for today. On last Monday's pre-Halloween Old Mole, Fran Michel organized the program around real-world monsters we face, both now and in the past, those who gnaw away at the institutions and the whole idea of public education, those who steal resources from non-white peoples, murder, and use race as a pretext, those who attack and repress and bomb while they solidify authoritarian rule. This week, Halloween has passed, but we'll carry that same theme in a new direction. Later in the program, I'll review a new film in which one recent real-life dictator is portrayed as a 250-year-old vampire still hovering over the country from whose people he sucked blood. We'll talk with Luisa Martinez about her trip to that country, Chile, and her participation in events there to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the coup that overthrew a democratically elected socialist government. I'll offer you the gift of a wonderful new novel by local author Vanessa Veselka. And Laurie Mercier will interview Dan Jaffe, professor at Portland State University, about his important new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. It's a full program, so I only have time to mention another anniversary that might have escaped your attention. We've just passed the 40-year mark since the United States invaded the tiny island of Grenada and squelched the revolutionary movement there. It was a movement worth knowing about, but not one our government and elites could tolerate in our own Monroe Doctrine backyard. Now, here's Laurie Mercier with Dan Jaffe.
This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Daniel Jaffe, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University and author of the new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Jaffe's research examines conflicts over water privatization and commodification in both the global North and South, and he also studies the international fair trade movement and social movements around food and agriculture. Among his other publications, his book, Brewing Justice, Fair Trade, Coffee, Sustainability, and Survival, received the C. Wright Mills Book Award. Well, welcome to KBOO, Daniel Jaffe.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, Daniel, I think most KBOO listeners are aware of the environmental damage that single-use plastic water bottles have caused. But your book importantly notes how, in addition to the energy footprint up to 2,000 times higher than tap water, the growing commodification of water has threatened a basic right, access to clean drinking water. How has this phenomenon of bottled water, which was hardly a thing 20 years ago, led to this crisis in public water systems?
Right. So it is worth getting a handle on the explosive growth of this relatively new product, this new commodity, right? It's gone from, you know, virtually nothing 4 decades ago to the world's most consumed packaged beverage today. The world consumed 120 billion gallons in 2021. Far and away the single most consumed packaged beverage, which means it is also incidentally responsible for the biggest share of the 600 to 700 billion single-use plastic bottles that are consumed and mostly disposed every year. So that's really important. It's become a $300 billion industry worldwide and counting. In the US, it's grown to $46 billion, right? It has become ubiquitous. Nearly 9 in 10 people in the US consume it. And what I say in the book, Unbottled, is that, you know, obviously bottled water is more than just a controversial product with a lot of negative environmental impacts. It also ends up being, you know, deeply connected to the social justice crisis of uneven access to safe and affordable water, both domestically here in the US and on a global scale. And that growing spending on bottled and packaged water and growing dependence on that product is exacerbating already wide economic and racial inequalities between the clean water haves and the clean water have-nots, again, kind of both domestically and globally. And I think that for various reasons, the bottled and packaged water industry, which is sort of led by the biggest names in sort of food and beverage firms, Coke, Pepsi, Nestle, and Danone, takes advantage of gaps in clean water provision, particularly across the global South. And so I write that this continued growth of bottled water and its either supplanting or its replacing of tap water for drinking ultimately is posing a threat to our public water systems in places that have widespread access to largely clean, safe tap water 24/7, and also more broadly to the human right to safe drinking water around the world.
Well, let's go to Flint, Michigan, where you begin your story. And I think most listeners will remember a decade ago that the city's polluted and toxic water system was endangering the health of residents, who were, ironically, as you point out, provided plastic water from Nestle, which was draining Michigan water supplies for its own profits in the packaged water business. Give us an update on the Flint story, since we haven't heard much about it in recent years.
Right. So people probably are aware that the Flint crisis is directly tied to neoliberal austerity, essentially a Republican governor who replaced essentially or overrode the city's democratically elected local officials, the city council and mayor, with a gubernatorially appointed emergency manager who essentially had fiat power over many important city decisions, ostensibly to sort of save the city from its financial woes. But the emergency manager, a series of emergency managers presided over a series of just fateful and ultimately truly awful decisions to switch the city's drinking water source from the very clean and long established Detroit water system to the polluted Flint River while it was waiting to hook up to a new pipeline to Lake Huron. And in so doing, inadequate treatment of the water led to rapid leaching of lead, other heavy metals, and bacteria from the city's water pipes, essentially destroying the water system and exposing Flint residents, a majority of whom were African-American, high rate of poverty, for 18 months to toxic drinking water. There's no other way to say it. It's an extreme example of environmental injustice. And obviously, in a drinking water emergencies like Flint, affected residents need an immediate, clean, safe alternative source of drinking water. What was provided in the immediate aftermath of the revelations of the unsafe water was, you saw the images, hundreds of millions of bottles of single-serving plastic bottled water in these, you know, multi-packs and pallets full, being distributed by volunteers, nonprofits, and then for a couple of years distributed free by the state of Michigan. Most of it, not all of it, coming from Nestle's branded water, some of that coming from groundwater, some of that coming from public water supplies elsewhere. And then the question is, though, you know, what happens after the immediate emergency? And what I talk about in Flint and what has happened, you know, Flint is essentially just the tip of the iceberg, but in a string of these sort of increasingly high profile drinking water emergencies around the US, is that we see that the default response is to turn to private plastic packaged water. And concerningly, this product becomes the alternative, quote unquote, safe water supply, not just for the immediate crisis, but increasingly for the medium term and even for the long term. 7 years after, 8 years after the Flint contamination was revealed, the city has, with federal funds, with state funds, has replaced about 95% of the lead contaminated service lines, virtually all, but contaminated and lead lined piping remains inside people's houses, remains inside appliances. The appliances and internal piping is just severely damaged, and residents largely distrust their tap water pretty profoundly. Now, stepping back just a second, in the earlier days of the crisis in Flint, the disaster in Flint, both local activist groups who had initially mobilized to demand the right to get bottled water distribution, but they, and then eventually the governor, asked the federal government, the Obama administration at the time, for a declaration of a major disaster. That would have, many argue, enabled them to get an alternative source of water, bulk water supplies in tanker trucks, something called water buffaloes that bring huge quantities of bulk water where residents could fill their own containers. That declaration was denied by the federal administration. And so what that meant was that for the duration of, really up until now, single-use plastic private bottled water has become the sole face of the response to the crisis, and that because residents have had their trust so damaged, many Flint residents, thousands and thousands of Flint residents, still depend on bottled water today for all of their drinking, but also cooking and sometimes other uses. And we see this pattern emerging in different parts of the U.S. And if you step back a little bit to look at the root causes of the broader deterioration of public water infrastructure in the U.S., we see a nearly five-decade process of federal disinvestment in supporting drinking water systems. Federal government funding for public water systems has dropped by about 80% adjusted for inflation since 1977, and that fiscal pain just gets passed down to cities and municipalities and localities, most of whom sort of make do and patch up the holes, but have to raise water bills and sewer bills as a result. But it is also in the poorest communities, ones with high rates of poverty, and largely communities dominated by communities of color, increasingly we see communities that are faced with real threats to drinking water safety.
And this just happened in Jackson, Mississippi, a year or two ago.
And so, yes, the capital of Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, a largely African-American city. And I should emphasize that overwhelming majority of tap water provided by public water systems in the U.S. remains safe to drink and does not violate any of the health provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But about 7 to 8% of water systems in the US every year do have one of those health-related violations. Some of them are fixed very quickly, but that 7 to 8% is not randomly distributed. It's overwhelmingly concentrated in rural communities, small water systems, and overwhelmingly communities that are low income, Black, and Latino, Latina. And so we have really not a water safety problem in this country, but a water injustice problem in this country. And not surprisingly, communities of color and low-income people, surveys and academic research shows this just incontrovertibly, far more distrust their tap water than do white and middle and upper income households. And they disproportionately are turning away from that tap water and turning toward bottled water. They are spending much more on bottled water on average, something like 2 to 1. And that higher spending is, of course, falling on the social groups who on average are least financially able to bear that extra burden. And so you see household spending hundreds, and in many cases, because they're using it for cooking as well, thousands of dollars per year to meet their cooking and drinking needs with bottled and packaged water. In some cases, they're turning away from water that is perfectly safe to drink. In other cases, they're turning away from water that is compromised. But I think rather than talk about any notion of misperceptions, I think we could look at this as a rational response by those communities to the history of systemic racism in the United States and the uneven distribution of those risks.
Right. And as you point out, that most of the bottled water in the United States does come from tap water sources.
Indeed.
But in addition to this kind of environmental injustice in the global north, in the United States, let's look at the global south or the majority world, where because of colonial legacies, debt, and austerity, many governments have been unable to extend tap water systems to their residents. And how have these global corporations dominated international discussions of water access? Right. And how's the global justice water movement challenging it?
Yeah, right. So in both the communities that represent kind of the South within the global North, the ones I've just been talking about, and also large swaths of the global South, urban, peri-urban areas, many places that the water system just have not been built out, have not been extended to reach the majority of the population, or if they do, systems can't adequately treat the water, or the water doesn't flow consistently. And so that becomes a problem of consistent access. And so, yes, the packaged water industry has been happy to sort of step in and fill the gap caused by all those factors you just described, where governments are either unable or unwilling, or a combination, to meet the needs of their citizens, residents, with clean, safe water. And so we see a pattern where overwhelmingly across the global South, bottled water is growing fastest, especially in Asia and parts of the Middle East and around the global South as well. And in fact, you know, this is a big point of contention, because the packaged water industry, and I should say that in the global South, there is a real drinking water, bottled water consumption is classed. You've got the kind of the branded water, the big four that I mentioned, own about, you know, a lot of subsidiaries in the global South. And that's about, you know, maybe a third to half of the consumption. But the other half is what some people call the water of the poor, refilling providers who take, you know, local groundwater, surface water supplies, or take straight from local tap water systems and filter the water and sell it at local refilling points. People bring their own containers, and that is cheaper and quality varies. But across the board, you see an increasing dependence on packaged water. And so that contentious issue is sort of entered into debates around meeting international goals for increasing access to safe water, like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And very quickly, there was a controversial decision made back in 2017 to reclassify packaged water as a so-called improved water source for the purposes of national governments meeting their targets under the Sustainable Development Goal number 6 for improving water access. And that's quite contentious, because it essentially absolves governments of the need to build out their water infrastructure and enables them to count the growth of the packaged water industry as a way of meeting those needs. Now, the resistance, you asked about the resistance, and yes, the book is centered on the movements that are challenging packaged water. And the global water justice movement emerged around the global South and North for about the last 20 years. They were the ones who fought a successful battle to get the UN to declare a human right to water and sanitation back in 2010. They've also fought privatization of drinking water systems and fought to support and sustain local public and community water systems. But what's less known and less attention is paid to the movements challenging packaged water. And I sort of argue that we need to really keep our eyes on packaged water and bottled water because it's the fastest growing form of the privatization or the commodification of drinking water worldwide. It's moving faster than the private water utility services industry. And as a result, I think we need to focus on movements challenging that. And around the world, I sort of say there's two facets. One is places where communities and movements are challenging the extraction of groundwater, sort of at the source, places where water is being extracted. But more interestingly, maybe this reclaim the tap facet of the movement, which is this kind of panoply, this constellation of really exciting initiatives bubbling up in local governments, university students, nonprofit organizations, even private businesses around the global north, but increasingly in the south as well, where it's essentially a turning back to public tap water, a demand that we revindicate or revalorize public tap water, building out networks of clean, new, shiny drinking fountains and water refilling stations. There are even apps people can download, like the Refill app, telling them where they can find the nearest source of water to refill these refillable water bottles. And it's a movement that's actually really caught on among young folks and Generation Z. And I quote bottled water industry reports and officials who are extremely concerned about the bite this is taking out of bottled water sales. And we are actually seeing a slowing and even a stalling of the growth in bottled water sales across the global north. First it was Europe, then it was the UK, then it was Canada, and now in the US, bottled water sales have essentially flatlined in the last year. And I think a lot of it is owed to this movement back to the tap. But just to close the circle, I think we now have sort of two counter forces. One is more privileged people in the global north increasingly are rejecting bottled water and turning back to and revaluing tap water and refilling. But communities of color, low-income communities facing disproportionate challenges to their water safety or strong perceptions that they are exposed to greater risk are still consuming more bottled water. And I think that unless we reinvest at the federal level here in the US in rebuilding and restoring our shared treasure of public water systems that we and our ancestors have been paying for decades and centuries, we will not restore trust in public water across the board unless we reinvest to make water reliably safe and trustworthy again for all of us.
And the right to include safe drinking water as a public good, a public right, along with many other rights that we have for housing, food, clean air, et cetera. And you provide some great examples of hundreds of cities around the world that have been working to re-municipalize their water systems, moving away from those private systems back to publicly funded systems that support all residents.
Right. And the last thing I'll mention in this reclaiming the tap facet is that these networks, both of anti-privatization movements, this is the facet that really, this links the opposition to bottled and packaged water with the opposition to privatization. In increasingly international initiatives, one of which came out of Canada but is now global, called the Blue Communities Initiative, is signing on local governments, universities, school districts, churches, et cetera, to a program where they support keeping water public, supporting the right to water, and banning bottled water in local governments and restoring access to public water in public places. This Blue Communities Initiative, they have 77 cities in 8 countries, and it is growing. And that's kind of the internationalization of the resistance to packaged water and the fight for clean water as a human right that I think really holds quite a lot of promise. And just overall, this topic, the more I researched the book and the farther I got into writing it, the more hopeful I felt about the prospect for a pushback against the commodification of water, at least on this particular front.
Well, thank you, Daniel Jaffe, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today And I want to encourage listeners to check out your important book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Thanks again, Daniel.
Thanks so much, Lori. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Lori Mercier and Dan Jaffe. On our September 11th program, we examined the 1973 coup in Chile. Old Mo Luisa Martinez was actually in that country for the 50-year commemoration events. In our conversation today, she tells how contentious that history still is and reminds us of the U.S. role. At the conclusion of our conversation, I'll give you my thoughts on the new film, El Conde, in which Augusto Pinochet, leader of the coup, is revealed to be one of the undead. This is Norm Diamond. I'm with Luisa Martinez. We had planned to do a program together on the 50th anniversary of the coup against Allende in Chile that took place on September 11th. We did, the Old Mole did a program, of course, on that coup, but Luisa, as it turned out, was in Chile. What were you doing in Chile?
Hey, Norm. So I was in Santiago for the 50th anniversary because I had been invited. There's an organization called Progressive International, and they helped organize, along with the Chilean Communist Party, a 50th anniversary event that took place in Recoleta, which is a commune in Santiago.
Tell us about the event. Actually, I had the pleasure of tuning in, seeing you online, so I know the answers to these questions, but you spoke as part of a panel. What was the panel, and what did you say?
Yeah, so it was part of a multi-day event. There was a series of events happening throughout Chile, but this is the one that, it wasn't just the Partido Comunista de Chile, but a number of other organizations had helped planned. It was a book fair, and there were a series of panels as well. And so the one that I spoke on was about the Monroe Doctrine, and I spoke alongside people like David Adler from Progressive International, who had invited me, Clara Lopez, who is a senator from Colombia and part of the Pacto. It's recently, that was Gustavo Petro's coalition. Gerardo Torres Zelaya, who is, he's like the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Honduras. And so there's a couple other people who gave some comments as well.
And why the Monroe Doctrine?
I don't know. That was just the panel. That was just the theme of the panel. It wasn't something that I had picked.
No, but I'm asking the significance of the Monroe Doctrine, why they would have chosen it for this occasion, somehow connecting to the commemoration of the coup against Allende.
Right. I mean, it's generally a part of what happened in Chile is part of the long shadow that the U.S. government has cast on not just Latin America, but the global South. But the Monroe Doctrine was certainly fitting as a theme for the 50th anniversary of the coup.
So this is partly an anti-imperialist event. You made some interesting choices in how you spoke. I've also had the pleasure of seeing your speech reprinted, so it's available online if people go searching for it. But what was your thinking in deciding how you wanted to respond to the event?
So my comments were a little bit more personal than I think of a lot of the other panelists. They gave political analyses that were a little bit more removed than mine. So I'm Chilean. I was born in Chile, and we came to the United States when I was very young, and I was an undocumented immigrant for a long time. And so I gave my perspective as a formerly undocumented Chilean in the United States, but also the role that the coup has played in my own political development, and that it isn't actually very far removed from a lot of people on the left, right? I've heard, and there's no studies on these types of things, unfortunately, so I couldn't confirm this, but I've heard from many other people that the coup in Chile, right, Allende's death is one of the first things that they learn about when they learn about imperialism. And it's not because there's so many Chileans in the United States. I know that because you just don't meet a whole lot of them. And I grew up in South Florida, right? So a lot of big immigrant community there. So it's not that. And I don't know why, to be honest with you. But it does, I believe, play in the development of one's consciousness on the left in the United States. And I did want to convey that to the audience of Chileans who were listening.
Well, I can suggest a couple of reasons. One, of course, is the heavy U.S. involvement in planning and supporting that coup and in supporting the regime that came out of it. Not only the torture and the disappearances, but the entire recasting of the economy in a way that was kind of an experiment for what happened then in the US and Britain and the global capitalist elite. This was the proving grounds for neoliberal capitalism and ended up making Chile into one of the most unequal countries in the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about the reasons why, but it was the United States any less brutal in Chile than they were in like Guatemala, for instance, you know, or Brazil, Argentina, any of these places, you know, Cuba before Fidel. Like, you know, it's hard for me to discern why Chile, why Allende is a well-known figure, just on the U.S. left. I'm not talking about most people in the United States. One of the reasons I posited was that he was in a lot of ways a perfect victim, that he was democratically elected. He took the electoral path, which was not, you know, in that era, wasn't the path that most of the Latin American left was taking, right? Not like now. Now, you very clearly, left movements in Latin America are taking the electoral path, but not then. So the fact that he had taken that path and that the United States still, that fascism ultimately took hold, that might be a reason.
Yeah, and the significance it had for people thinking about what social transformation would be, both in the global South and even here, whether the electoral path was a possibility. One other quick factor was, of course, this was 1973, whereas many of the instances you mentioned came earlier when there was much less of an organized political left movement in this country. And then coming out of the 60s, Allende had more significance here than, for instance, coups against Mossadegh in Iran or Arbenz in Guatemala that happened in the 50s. Anyway, it's worth thinking about the continuing significance of Allende for us. But back to your experience, you were there. The panel that you mentioned was a couple of days before 9/11. What about being there 9/11, that day? What was it like to be in Chile on the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, well, I had taken part of the book fair event that the Partido Comunista had organized. But I also was part of two marches. One was in the morning, and that was the one that everybody went to. And so that one was an interesting experience. So right away, before the march even started, it was part of a confrontation with police. So O'Higgins Avenue, which is the main vein of Santiago, it's like closing down, you know, Sunset Avenue in Los Angeles or something like that. It's this huge, really trafficked avenue. They closed it down and people were gathering to start the march. And the police, for whatever reason, had just randomly blockaded the back end. Right? Not the part where you're marching forward, they blockaded the back. And so I was just wandering the avenue taking photos. Again, it's like shutting down such a huge street. And I was like, okay, well, ready to be part of the march soon. And I go to walk up and we saw the blockades there. And so people immediately got pissed. Because it was, you know, they were understandably confused. It just seemed like there was no reason to block it off. So people started yelling and I was like, okay, well, this is going to get violent pretty soon. But at some point, either somebody forced the blockade open or the gates open or the police had let us in. But that was before the march had even started and it just kind of went downhill from there. So lots of tear gas, which is fine. It's not the first time getting tear gas, but the water cannons were definitely new. And so anybody who was part of the George Floyd rebellion in Portland, it was that kind of vibe. So luckily I'd ran into a friend of mine, Vijay Prashad, and another Chilean activist that I had known, and you know, I found a group of people to stick with. The police called Carabineros there. They had just tried to, you know, block off certain parts, have people run in different directions, and really made an effort to disperse the crowd. And so at some point, they blocked us off where we just couldn't continue with the rest of the march, which was unfortunately down to the cemetery where President Allende was buried. So it was interesting, the police tactics that they had used in Chile.
And the point, of course, the police, I don't know whether this is a surprise or not, the police were not in favor of commemorating the coup.
Yeah, that could certainly be argued. I will say that President Boric, the current president of Chile, he was a part of the march for about 10 minutes, and then he left. There's a photo of him at the beginning, right, with a big banner. And it's clear that he is not in charge of the police in Chile, right? The police and the military. And he was never a military guy, right? He's a middle-class guy who got elected. So it was clear that probably the reason why he left so early is because he probably didn't want photos of him getting tear gassed by his own police force.
Ah. You had another march as well, or another demonstration in Chile that day?
Yes. Later that night was the Nunca Más march, and that was mostly women. It was about about 6,000 women all dressed in black, some of which carrying candles. And it was actually a silent march. It was very much a change in tone from the march earlier that day.
And Nunca Más means?
Never again.
Yeah.
Never again. It's part of the movement of women who certainly decried what happened on 9/11 and its outset, but also a movement made up of mothers who still to this day are searching for the bodies of their children who had disappeared, particularly in the 5 days after the coup where we saw the most people missing. But yeah, that one was very much a different change of tone, silent march. The police who were there were undercover. You know, they weren't like in full military uniform. You could tell though, because they're terrible at trying to look normal. They all had the same exact black jacket and shiny shoes, and perfectly combed hair, but it was peaceful. At least for the time that I was there, I was there for about 3 hours.
This has been Luisa Martinez. I don't know how often Cabo was able to do this, but we have our own foreign correspondent on the scene. So Luisa, thanks very much. We're glad to have you back here and we'll do more programs together. That was Luisa Martinez. This is Norm Diamond talking about her experience in Chile on the commemoration, the 50th anniversary of the coup and the rise of fascism in Chile, the coup against Allende. One of the things Luisa saw in roaming around Santiago were posters everywhere for a new film. The film is by Pablo Larraín. It's on Netflix, available in this country, came out to coincide with that 50th anniversary, 50th commemoration of the coup by General Pinochet and the military against Salvador Allende. And the film is called El Conde. El Conde in English is the Count. And the Count, it was Pinochet's nickname. Augusto Pinochet died in 2006, at the time facing punishment for everything he did in Chile, for the coup, for the dictatorship, for the torture, the disappearances, for the money that he stole and his family stole, and probably wasn't going to be punished for this, but of course for the egregious introduction of capitalist neoliberalism into Chile that we just talked about in the interview with Luisa. The plot of the film says he didn't actually die. He faked his death. He is still a presence, is the point that the film is trying to make. He's still a presence in Chile, which he very much is. But turning him into a vampire, you got the reference right when the film is called The Count, takes him back in time. He's been in service to the ruling class, this film says, for the last 250 years. And it visually reinforces that point by having him as a shadow that persists over Santiago. It has him in full military regalia flying over the city. So the premise is he's insulted by being charged as a thief, and he decides finally that he wants to die. His family arrives. They've done extremely well, of course, under his rule. They gathered the spoils. But now, if he wants to die, they want to figure out where all the loot is hid. I will add parenthetically that investigators, this isn't part of the film, investigators have traced tens of millions of dollars to hundreds of bank accounts that he set up all around the world. Some of that, of course, does come out in the film. But the family arrives. Along with them comes a young nun. Now, she's there as an accountant they can trust, because she's this young person and a religious person, but she has a couple of other agenda items on her own. And one of them is to have an exorcism to get the devil out of this vampire that is Pinochet. And second, she's there with a secret mission from the Catholic Church in Chile to try to gather as much of the loot for them as she can pull off, you know, bearer bonds, things like that. Anything she finds, go back to the church. And then there's a big reveal at the end that I'm not going to tell you right now, but the point of which is that efforts toward fascism in Chile and elsewhere will continue around the world. The film's a clever way of exposing Pinochet's crimes, and some of that is insider stuff. Early on, when he's charged as a vampire centuries before Chile, when he's charged with some crimes before he massacres the people charging him, he says the lines, "I don't remember, but it's not true. And if it is true, I don't remember." Well, for Chileans, that's a reminder. That's exactly what Pinochet said in real life when he was asked, I presume by the court, by the Spanish court that tried him, the judge of which incidentally was on the panel with Luisa in Chile a couple of weeks ago, or a few weeks ago. That's exactly what he said when he was asked, you know, under oath, whether he had headed the secret police. He said, "I don't remember, but it's not true. And if it is true, I don't remember." That was that reference. Beyond that, of course, the nun in her conversations with all the children of the family, in the work that she does as an accountant, uncovers all the corruption, or much of it, the diversion of funds and the killings. And the family members just respond kind of with glee. You get this elite response as they acknowledge they were entitled to all this loot. After all, their father, did this great thing by preventing the rise of any kind of alternative to elite rule. I guess one or two reservations about the film. What do we get when we focus on one person? The problems, of course, in Chile were systemic. It wasn't just that one person made things happen, although perhaps in a literary device, it makes it easy to see the crimes by that focus on one person. What's left out, really, is something that Luisa and I just talked about, and that would be the U.S. role in the coup and in supporting fascism in Chile. That's left out of the film almost entirely. There's a very subtle reference at the very end, as part of this big reveal, when the newly reinvigorated youth vampire that is Pinochet is taken off to school as a child. He's taken off to school now in the present in a school that has the name Escuela de las Americas, School of the Americas, which of course was the U.S. facility at Fort Bragg that trained the Chilean military behind the coup. I've been talking about the film El Conde, a film by Pablo Larraín. It is available now on Netflix. It's not an easy film to watch. It is a spoof. There's humor in it. There's also a lot of gore. Watch it with some discretion, but it's absolutely topical in how it approaches Chile. This is Norm Diamond with a review of El Conde. Before the film review, I talked with Luisa Martinez. Finally, on today's program, I'd like to tell you about a wonderful new novel by Vanessa Veselka. The Great Offshore Grounds is not only beautifully written, but also written with a rare grasp of class and gender dynamics. Discovering a new experience, one that enriches your sense of self and of possibilities, can be a gift. Being told about a new book, one that's thoughtful, beautifully written, on expansive themes, likewise can be a gift. That is true even if the themes illuminate the limited sense of possibilities for fictional characters you grow to care about. I've found such gifts on occasion in the recommendations by our book moles, Larry Bolden and Matt Witt. Now, I'd like to offer you such a gift in the form of a novel that captivated me. The novel is The Great Offshore Grounds. Its author, Vanessa Veselka, is a Portland writer with a wide range of work experience and acute class and gender sensibilities. To give you some glimpses of Veselka's thoughtfulness and craft, Patricia will read some passages as I tell you more. This is a book about location and direction, about where we are, where we're going, and if we even know where we are and where we're going, or really know where we've come from. It's about the precariousness of our lives and the limits of our self-knowledge. It uses dead reckoning, a nautical phrase, as metaphor for our place in the world. Dead reckoning is what sailors use when they have no other means of establishing their position than through vague knowledge of where they started and how long it might have taken them to get to wherever they might be. Time, too, is a theme in this book. And nautical experience, the work done aboard ships, is more than metaphor here.
The problem of location has never been simple. Do you fix a point and aim at wherever you want to go? Or do you locate yourself in relation to the shore, memory, and landmarks? Baleen whales navigate this way. Toothed whales do not. Early sailors preferred celestial navigation, best to rely on something outside the grasp of this world. But celestial navigation doesn't solve the problem of unknown shores and cloud cover, which is why dead reckoning is the fallback of sailors, a fixed beginning, speed, and trajectory. Dead reckoning is how wolves cross snowy hillsides, how pumas slip between desert ridges in the night. Out of satellite range in open ocean without lighthouse beacon or buoy, dead reckoning is a sailor's final hope. But solve one problem, and it has puppies. Give a man a fish, and it's not his fault. But teach a man to fish, and he eats everything in the ocean. Starting point, mode of transport, goal.
Work, too, is a theme, not only on ships, but driving a cab or as a security guard, with vivid descriptions that take us inside the experience. And the we I alluded to as living precarious lives is working class. As I said, this is a novel keenly attuned to class and also gender. Of the four main characters, three are women, two sisters, and the woman who raised them. The fourth, a boy from the streets adopted into their little family years ago as a teenager, has an important but lesser role. For me, the account of cab driving, the interactions among the drivers of various races and nationalities, the driver's differing motivations, all that was a revelation. Reading of those work-related passages would take too long, but here are a couple of quick accounts of the humiliations of searching for a job. First, for one of the sisters.
At 5 o'clock, people started leaving the temp office. At a quarter after, the associate placement counselor called Cheyenne back into the administrative catacombs. The associate sat her down, reviewed her clipboard, and told Cheyenne she had a wonderful future in servitude, if she had the right outlook, which she didn't. Cheyenne made it through with her eager face on, though barely. The counselor congratulated her on her wealth of hard-won but unrelated skills. We'll call you for sure. Meanwhile, get some slacks.
And then, for the woman who raised the sisters.
She closed the nickel ads. If you were over 25 and looking for a job, everyone expected a pageant of humiliation and a good story. Are you a recovering addict? Are you married to a bride hoarder? Are you a homemaker new to the market with an autistic son or a husband with cancer? Tell me, what exactly is your excuse for being 52 and broke?
From the very first page, the explicit context is capitalism, both as it has developed historically and in the strange, if equally exploitive form it takes in the present. The book begins with a wedding set at a lighthouse on an island offshore from Seattle. Immediately, Veselka situates the participants in a class structure, from the rich guests to the poor relatives to the people preparing the food and servicing the grounds. She works in some of the backstory of the lighthouse, its 19th century origins, as she says, at the dawn of massive capital expansion and speculation, and the toll it took on the worker who had to shovel tons of coal to keep it lit. The super wealthy bridegroom is the biological father of the two grown-up sisters. What Veselka says about him from the sister's perspective is also a way to characterize modern capitalism.
They had not followed his career. When he lost interest in them, they lost interest in him. Still, they knew the broad strokes. He had started in software development. Rich in stock, he had branched out into sidelines, like the import-export business that employed the Tibetans. From there, it was less concrete. He had, it seemed, transcended goods and services almost entirely, diversifying into multiple shell companies, replicating and mirroring, acquiring and sloughing off, unmoored from states of reality like warehouses and people, to become an algorithmic superstructure of predatory capital, ever-moving, ever-present, unfixable in space and time.
The perspective throughout is working class. An underlying question as the characters travel through the country is, to whom does this country belong? The sisters and brother cross the country by car, as well as by plane, and by ship along the entire West Coast and beyond. The author beautifully integrates descriptions of nature and landscape with history, flashes of psychological insight, and her own reflections on life.
He walked on the thin dirt footpath along an arterial road between bushes and intermittent guardrails. Every passing car spraying him with water. It went on like this for a mile. Not all miles are the same. The mile between you and digging a ditch is shorter than the one between you and the body of someone you love. And that mile is different from the one between you and the person who needs money as much as you do that you can't pay back. The mile he was walking felt like a combination of all three.
Or another.
Then they came to the Great Powder River, which was fed by the Little Powder as well as oil from pipeline breaks, Red Cloud's war, and benzene as it joined the Yellowstone. The Yellowstone, which already had inherited so much, the Bighorn and the Wind and the Tongue, as it flowed toward the Missouri River, which had no choice but to inherit the watershed as it drained toward the Mississippi, that unstoppable force. And maybe there just is no way out of history, no matter how much you want to come from a different story. You can't.
This is the story of a quest for origins, for identity. It's a quest based on a myth, as many literary and real-life quests are. In this case, it's a myth told by a mother figure to two young girls, born on the same day, raised together. The girls interpret the quest differently and respond to it each in her own way. They pull together and pull apart. They each find different answers and only partial resolution. There is no neat ending here, but more self-knowledge than when they began.
Having an organizing myth is good. This had been her thinking. Myths give heroic shape to adolescence in a time devoid of initiation. The story was supposed to free them from the mundane. It was a condom to lower the risk of spiritually transmitted diseases like monogamy and patriarchy. But to have power, myths need drama. They need transcendent beauty. And in the ugly blocks of subsidized housing, surrounded by fast food chains, penned in by arterial roads without sidewalks, over that year when they had moved from one dismal apartment without natural light to the next, always with black mold blooming on walls punched with jacks for cable you can't afford to use, how was she supposed to give them that? And in order for them to work, myths require initiation, and initiation requires profound emotional confusion. You need to lose something you hold dear, something you thought made you what you were. That's the price of entry.
Not only is this an engaging, well-constructed novel, but the line-by-line writing is felicitous and sometimes exceptional. The author's insights and reflections are worth pausing over and pondering. The facts and details she provides with considerable expertise support her work-oriented, working-class point of view. She adds two fruitful devices I haven't yet mentioned. In one of them, historical characters like Sir Walter Raleigh in full period regalia show up in a kind of hallucinatory magic realism to remind us that our threads of colonialism and imperialism run deep. In another, she uses occasional italicized passages as a kind of commentary on or deepening of her character's own thinking, sometimes as if they were able to step back and reflect on their lives or situations in ways she otherwise shows them less able. So this is my gift to you on today's Old Mole. The book is The Great Offshore Grounds by Vanessa Veselka. And this is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's it for today's jam-packed Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and her guest Dan Jaffe, to Luisa Martinez, and to Patricia Kohlberg. Thanks always to KBOO's staff, doing so much with so little. If you're able to help out the station, go to KBOO's website to donate. The Old Mole will return next Monday morn with fresh programming. Meanwhile, stay safe in these perilous times, and do stay active. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll go out with just a little bit more of Casa de las Flores by Quijarema.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Ayo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.